Okay, so here's our agenda. Thank you for joining us on the call today, Chris. We really appreciate it. We know you're very busy, and we're really looking forward to kind of getting your input on this Verifiable Claims Task Force work. Just to be clear, we are minuting the call and we're recording audio. So if you're not okay with either one of those things, please let us know. We do need to minute.
No, you have my permission.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so maybe we could start off with a quick introduction to you. We're going to be sharing this with multiple interest groups and working groups at W3C. So a quick intro of yourself and your background, and then we can jump into the agenda, which is like talking about problem statement and definitions and all that kind of stuff. So let's do an intro first.
Yeah, so I've been involved with online communities since the early 80s. I was on CompuServe, which was one of the first national systems. I was head of the International Computer Consulting Association's consulting board on there. I had hosted a number of BBSs. I published the first BBS for the Mac, and I published the first Mac interface for a online community. Was also involved with early pre-internet methodologies for transmitting information, including FidoNet, which was sort of a predecessor to news, but in many ways, when you look at it today, you know, it's a peer-to-peer protocol, and I often pull up my old documents on that when various people pull up patent documents and claim, "Well, we invented such and such," and I can say, "No, we did it back in the 80s." Later, in the late 80s, I formed a company called Consensus Development, recognizing that both the technological consensus problem in things like databases and distributed architectures, as well as the human side of that problem, was the core of what I really wanted to be working on for the next, you know, 25 years. And came out with my first product, and it failed, and the reason why it failed was people didn't trust it. And that's when I entered into the cryptography community, was really on the ground floor of RSA, did a lot of consulting for RSA, had the exclusive right to the RSA Ref library for doing standards implementations of the RSA algorithm, was also involved in privacy efforts, including anti-clipper and other stuff in the early 90s, which ultimately set the stage for writing the reference implementation of SSL, then later leading the standards effort for the next 4 years to at the IETF for TLS 1.0. And I was the editor along with Tim Dirks for the standard, and was sort of the technically was not the director of the working group, but the ran the mailing list, ran the online communities, ran a number of the events. So for all practical purposes, I was the de facto director of that working group, and we published version 1 of the standard in 97, and today it's the widest deployed security standard in the world, with over $500 million worth of business just in the United States alone going over TLS. Some of the architecture, early architecture decisions that we made have proved to be solid. Things like perfect forward secrecy, which was something that was in the spec early on, has only been implemented in the last couple of years, and I'm quite pleased, with its deployment. And it's also not only used to secure the web, it's used to secure other standards. The ports that I registered for doing SSL with email, later TLS with email, Google last year reported that 60% of all outgoing email was secured by TLS, and 50% of all incoming email was secured by TLS, which is in great excess of any secured by PGP or SMIME or any of the other mail standards. In the last 10 years, I've been an angel investor. I've been involved with online communities of a variety of natures, in particular in the mobile community. In the cryptographic field, I was CTO at Certicom, where I led some early efforts on sort of pre-blockchain smart contracts, smart signatures, and but it was too early, too soon, and in the last couple of years, I've been bringing a lot of those skills back where I worked with Silent Circle for a secure Android platform, and then most recently, I've been doing a lot of work in the blockchain and consensus engines of trust, again, in the last year, including teaching at Blockchain University and, consulting for big companies and small, and working on the OASIS standards, trying to help XDI move to using blockchain.
Awesome. So that is a fantastic introduction to you. Thank you. And all of these reasons are why we're so interested in getting your input on where this verifiable claim stuff is going, because we think you are uniquely qualified to kind of talk to, whether or not it's a problem that needs solving, potentially how, you would go about solving the problem, and so on and so forth. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump in to the main agenda. What we're trying to do during this call is get your thoughts about what we've written down so far. So like problem statement definitions, user-centric versus service-centric, do you think there's a problem here to be solved? Where should we do the work? Things of that kind of nature. So that's the kind of feedback we're looking for. And let me go ahead and just link to the problem statement first, and let's go through that, see if you've got any concerns or issues with how we're defining the problem. So there's a link in IRC that I just put in there.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to do, the main gist of the way we're stating the problem here is we're talking about user-centric design. So we're asserting that there is no widely user-centric standard for expressing and transacting verifiable claims, also known as credentials and attestations, via the web. We believe that, there is a desire to create such an ecosystem. And so by user-centric, we've tried to define what user-centric means through talking about what some of the design ramifications are here. So for example, an example of a service-centric system is something like OpenID Connect or Facebook or Twitter, right? Your identity
and
provider.
And I'm very familiar. Yeah, and I'm very familiar. The user-centric movement, as far as calling it user-centric, was really pushed in the late 90s, early 2000s. Augmenting the social network, or I'm trying to remember what the augmenting paper was, but that was the early thing. And then I've been in a member of the Internet Identity Workshop community pretty much from the beginning. And I'm absolutely in, you know, I mean, I think the core of the thing to me of my alignment with the problem statement is the user-centric. I personally, user-centric has kind of been co-opted a little bit in the last few years. It's probably the right word to use, but, you know, I've been moving in increasingly over to self-sovereign as the key phrase for this, which is a little bit distinct from user-centric, but I think, you know, clearly the same territory. And I think it's important for a variety of reasons. First off, there's an innate power imbalance in our society where, you know, individual power is severely hampered by both the you know, financial power and the legal authority and power of other parties. And it's always been, you know, going back to the U.S. Constitution, you know, how do you enable the individual to balance that power among authorities around them? And, you know, and I think that's the because of the, you know, the natural power of aggregation, of financial authority, et cetera, you know, we need forms of things like, you know, everything from the class action lawsuit, you know, et cetera, to allow to overcome these sort of natural aggregation and network effects that happen in systems. So I feel like, you know, we have to balance those natural powers with powers that are given to the user. And I think that's where, you know, the self-sovereign word is a little bit stronger and why I use that myself. Now, clearly, the world in the last few years has been going, you know, we have this thing where we move to centralized structures, and then we have the problems of those centralized structures, and then we move out to decentralized, and, you know, with whether or not it was the PC in the 80s or whatever, and then we move back to centralized. We have this back and forth, and we're in the middle of a centralized power surge with things like Facebook and, you know, on other entities, governmental powers wanting to make it very easy to be able to do things. I'm not a libertarian, and I'm not, I don't really consider myself a crypto anarchist or even a cypherpunk per se. But, you know, I do believe in that balance, and I think clearly that's part of my motivation for being involved with a lot of the decentralized technologies that are finally possible today. But, you know, they aren't, they haven't won. And there may be a lot of people like banks, et cetera, that are going, hey, this is something we need to investigate. But, you know, at this point, there's no proven, example there. So, walking through this, user-centric is the first thing that I do. I am also as far as, I think that the space of verifiable claims, credentials, and attestations is a very important sweet spot. Obviously, interoperability is powerful. We've already talked about the server-centric architectures. People who lose their Facebook relationship for whatever reason, then lose, you know, years worth of identity and reputation and history with their peers. And, you know, they're, if you go by the original definition of social network, individuals own their social network. It shouldn't be owned by a company. And increasingly, Facebook and other entities are making it very difficult for their data to be there. So again, it you know, vendor lock-in is an issue. Fragility, or the opposite of it, a need for resilience, are important issues. It's possible you might want to consider using the word resilience in here as opposed to fragility, but
That's a good interoperable point.
Standards that cross industries clearly, we have a lot of issues in the areas of I'm a big fan of privacy. I write a lot about it, but then if you look at, you know, how a lot of these things are legislated, things like HIPAA, the U.S. Privacy for health records, in many ways enforces a man in the middle, which is the antithesis to everything that cryptographers want to try to avoid, and it's kind of mandated by the legislation. So that again has to do with kind of the centrality of things. You know, I think that maybe they'll come up a little bit later in this discussion, but when I also look at things from a cryptographic perspective, in order to prevent things like correlation, which is not really discussed in here, to allow for certain kinds of privacy things that are mandated in the European Union in the next couple years, that you can't do them cryptographically if it isn't designed from a self-sovereign perspective at the bottom.
And you're asserting that it should be designed from a self-sovereign perspective?
Yeah, should be, and I don't know how that from a cryptographic point of view, doing it the other way, I don't know how to do. I don't see a way to cryptographically enforce policies. You can have policies. You can have wonderful rules and policies about how all of this information should or should not be shared and under what, you know, what restrictions and things of that nature. And you can enforce them entirely by policy and then have things like, you know, more Jews died in Holland during World War II as a percentage of population than they did in Germany, because Holland had a wonderful civil service that respected Jews and all of that. But then things changed. So just because it's working great now doesn't necessarily mean it's working great in the future. And I think that's the root of why the European standards are so much tougher than the U.S. standards, which aren't really built on the human rights privacy, but are more built upon a different form of privacy, which has to do with economic rights. So I don't know how to solve some of the European style rights to privacy from a service-centric perspective. I think it can only be solved from a user-centric perspective. And
Thirty plus
years of working in the community.
Right. So, you know, looking at the problem statement, do you feel like we're in the right ballpark here? We're asserting there's no user-centric standard for expressing verifiable claims. There are a number of downsides, which you covered just now. And if we were to do one thing, and that's to endeavor to create this self-sovereign based mechanism for expressing and transacting verifiable claims. Do you think that would be a worthwhile endeavor to undertake?
Yes.
Okay.
The only thing it feels just a little bit missing from here is, you know, the area of not just policy but also cryptography is maybe missing from here. But
okay,
I don't know if it
has to be. In what way do you feel cryptography is missing? Like, we point out that, you know, this stuff needs to be done in a cryptographic way. It's not a policy. It is not a policy-based solution that we should be searching for. It should be a cryptographic-based solution.
And I don't see that precise. I mean, if I look at like the problem statement, there's really nothing in the problem statement that talks about securing cryptographically.
Right. So I think that's just a fundamental assumption we're making, but I think you're right that we should point out that that's how we intend to try and address some of the problem statement. One of the things that we were asked not to do is try and propose a solution. They wanted us to just identify the problem that we were trying to tackle and then get around to the technical solution, you know, when we actually get into the technical work. But I think you raise a good point.
Well, but you're not mentioning it at all, and you will have to be diving into it. I mean, I think there are, you know, even if you don't necessarily talk about I think there may be two principles, maybe there are more principles but at least, you know, a couple of principles might be, you know, necessary to say. And, you know, we've already talked about the principle of the self-sovereign side of things, but I would also maybe add to that that, you know, something along the lines of, you know, minimum disclosure required to interact, which might include methods like selective disclosure and things of that nature. But I think we don't know, you know, it's a hard problem space. So, you know, we want to encourage, you know, minimum exposure but we want to enable business interactions and cooperation, whatever. So what is the minimum necessary to be able to do so and not go beyond it wherever possible? Whereas right now we have a tendency to, you know, everything gets exposed.
Right, yep.
You know, it's an all or none.
Right, yep. Okay, all right. We will try and work that in. Do you think that's best in the problem statement or somewhere else, like ramification?
I think it might be more of a principle
type
of thing.
Okay, all right. Okay, all right, so that's good. Are there any other concerns that you have over the problem statement, or do you feel like, you know, with the modifications that you pointed out, okay, that should be good. Okay, all right, so let's jump.
Another principle is the area of correlation. I think that's, you know, a principle that may not be mentioned here.
Right, the area of correlation. We were going to talk a bit about definitions, you know, user-centric versus service-centric and user-centric versus service-centric design, but I feel like you've already kind of covered those things, right? I think you've made it very clear that, you know, a self-sovereign based design you feel is you know, a better way to address the problem than, for example, a service-centric design like Facebook or Twitter or things of that nature. That's a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. You know, I don't think it belongs in here, but I personally believe, yes, there are things in a user-centric design that make it harder for large organizations to do certain types of things. But on the other hand, they have more money and more power.
Right. Yep.
So I consider that to be an acceptable difference.
Okay. We were going to go through stakeholders and benefits next. So let me try and find stakeholders. That section.
I mean, I think the biggest. I have some. I can live with this. Every time I hit consumers, I mean, I understand you're trying to break the worse naming thing where, you know, it's information providers and information. There's some older terminology here. But whenever I hit consumers of this list, I keep on wishing it was another word.
So let me try and outline. Do you understand that consumers here are credential consumers, and these are large organizations
absolutely.
Like Walmart or Target? Okay, all right.
Absolutely. I just don't like. I mean,
got it. Can you think of a replacement term? And if not now, you know, we can always send an email in. But I didn't know if you had heard. Let's go through the ecosystem first and then hear your thoughts on it. So the ecosystem that we're looking at right now is composed of four basic actors. You've got verifiable claim issuers or credential issuers. So these are like the Department of Motor Vehicles, U.S. Passport Office, your grocery store providing a loyalty card. So these organizations issue credentials, and they issue them to people or organizations. So we call these next things like credential holders. So they receive the credential, and they have the choice of where they store that credential. So maybe it's in a wallet, a digital wallet on their mobile phone. Maybe they are storing it in a cloud. But ultimately, they pick where they want to store it.
I think issuers is great. The definition is solid. The only thing that is, I feel, to me, obviously missing is that if we talk about the way real world trust is,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about human trust,
mm-hmm.
When it manifests itself in a, in an enterprise,
mm-hmm.
There is a lot of peer-to-peer trust.
Mm-hmm.
I have a relationship with Joe at the Power Bar company because we've been doing business for a long time together, and he and his organization have impressed me as to things. So I think there's a little bit of a only these big issuers, whereas I'm just as interested in, the ability for, John Callis, the former CTO of PGP, to basically be able to go and issue a statement about, my 30-year history of working with him in the standards community, as much as I am, having VeriSign, which has changed hands so many times in the last few years that, Google almost banned every Symantec certificate in Google Chrome because they were mishandling them,
which is
a better credential.
So we certainly are talking it down to that level. Right. So we're certainly focused on enabling a very level competitive playing field, especially allowing individuals to not only self-assert claims, but assert claims on other individuals, right? And it just be a part of the system, right? It's not any harder to do that than for a large organization to issue claims. One of the pushback that we've heard from Brad Hill, who's the chair of the Web Application Security Group at W3C, is that he doesn't see how a system like that could scale. He said that that is a very, very, very complex trust ecosystem, and he feels that it would fall under its own weight. So the ability for anyone
you
to
mean,
be able to
having it at the peer level? You mean at the peer level?
I
certainly can. I think that it does have to be constrained. But I think that's kind of constrained by recipe than it more than it is constrained by the size.
Right.
So, I mean, if you look at, let's say, you know, good old-fashioned PGP, you know, PGP's trust thing is often overinterpreted, but it fundamentally is, do I believe that the party at the other end has, you know, properly generated a public and private key pair? I mean, it's really what all it really means. You know, the problem is it was that's not what it really says. It's not precise enough. And if the recipe was precise enough to really be what it truly is, as opposed to people's sort of broader interpretation of, oh, those two people have met, or those two people are friends, or those two people, you know, these all these other things that got interpreted into the PGP, you know, what that credential meant, that's when, you know, PGP breaks. So having good, some, you know, some good recipes that, you know, are very precise as to their nomenclature and, and what the rules are for that, that I think can be done and can scale. But allowing anybody to sort of arbitrarily make a weird reputation claim in a in a not well defined reputation area, no, you're that's madness. You'll there's no way to scale that.
Right. So one I forget who said it, but one person said that what we're looking at is islands of interoperability here. So, for example, you know, an education, like the education industry, will have its own way of describing credentials in a standard format, and there will be issuers in that industry that are trusted.
So,
and the organizations that consume those credentials will understand who those issuers are. And
so I think then that might mean that there's a fifth category. And if you look at the real world, that fifth category is all over the place. You know, you have a, you do not, well, I'm trying to remember what the name of the, so the school that I teach at, is, damn, what is the name of the term of the organization that they're part of? It's like the
Federation or
accreditation. Yeah. So you know, I don't get a a diploma from an accrediting body, but it has a big impact upon the diploma that I do get, that there is a recipe that basically says, you know, this is a US-wide accrediting body, which is not as prestigious as a regional accrediting body, which doesn't make any sense to me, but that's the reality of the world.
Right.
And you know, having being accredited by, you know, having a recipe for accreditation from multiple bodies is better. So it could be that you have a fifth type, which are people that are creating some of these types of recipes. You know, that, as you said, an industry recipe for education, or an industry for, say, U.S. healthcare, which would have very different requirements because of things like HIPAA and U.S. laws and things of that nature than a recipe for, say, a European Union thing. So, you know. So anyhow, that's my minor.
Okay, that's all good. And so,
in the pool.
talking about the ecosystem, or going back to the ecosystem, the last group we have are, you know, what we call credential consumers. These are organizations that ask you to prove your age, or that you live in a certain state, or that you have a certain professional license. So with those four major players in the ecosystem, do you feel like that's At least there are those four major players, and then maybe there are those other mechanisms that you just described. Does the ecosystem make sense to you? Like, does it seem like it's the right ecosystem to try and build, where each one of these actors is kind of there can be many of them in the ecosystem?
Yes, I you know, with the thing that, you know, with the old word was relying party, right? Consumers. I agree that consumers might be better than relying party. I'm uncomfortable with consumers because it's just so much when you're trying to communicate it crosses into the people side of this equation. So,
agreed.
You know, are they dependents? Are they followers? Are they clientele? Campaigners?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
But
consumer
bugs me.
Okay, all right. So we'll mark that as an issue, and then we'll take it back to the group and see if they can come up with a better name. And then, of course, in the meantime, if you can think of something, we'd love to hear from you as well. I'd like to shift gears really. Go ahead.
Can I quickly say one thing?
Sure.
I also appreciate the difference between an issuer and a curator. So I wrote a lot about rating systems and the design of rating systems in my blogs on collective choice, and including, you know, we implemented our suggestions in one of our own rating systems and got demonstrably better rankings and ratings. And I think that there, if you're looking at from that terminology, there's a big difference between a rating and a ranking. So issuers in many ways are in kind of the same space as rating, but I think ranking requires a lot more, and that's kind of where your curators are. And so they have a very different role in sort of saying someone's credit rating is greater than that of someone else's, as opposed to the fact that yes, this person has, you know, good credit with Visa. This Visa card has always been paid on time is a very different thing than a curation of a lot of different ratings together. So I think it's important. I also think that curators may because of their power and because that in order to do some of their stuff, they have to correlate things, that they may have to have stricter requirements in many ways than issuers.
Right. So one of the things that we talk about when we talk about curators is we make sure that at least, you know, there are, of course, a couple of technical proposals on the table. And one of the technical proposals says that the curator should not be able to track where you're using your credentials. So it should be blinded from the consumers that are using those credentials, because if it were, able to kind of figure out where you were sending those credentials, then it would be able to build a very strong profile of your behavior and what you're doing and other things like that. So we're certainly very sensitive to that, and we're trying to build that into the protocols.
And that's that's also where the power is. And to a certain extent, that's where the money is.
Right.
You know, ultimately issuers, if you look at this from a who benefits from it, the it's the curators and consumers in your thing that benefit the most from this? Mm-hmm. In many ways, issuers are customers, are I swear I hate the word consumer and customer, are the, to a certain extent, serving the community, but they're also serving users. They can charge a user for an ID and things of that nature, which is very different than a curator who can force somebody to do something. There's more power in a curator.
Right. Yep. Okay. So agreed. So switching gears pretty quickly, we're running out of time. I don't know if you have an extra 15 minutes to spend with us today. If not, then we're going to have to jump past some of these questions. You have an extra 15?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So switching really quickly to technologies that can achieve this kind of ecosystem and address the problem statement. So if you were to try and build something that would achieve try and create this ecosystem, there are people that are saying that the technologies already exist. It's OpenID Connect or SAML or some variation of OAuth. What are your thoughts on this? Do you feel like the technology already exists and it's just a matter of, reusing, building something on top of OpenID Connect? Or do you feel like there's still some fundamental technologies that are not quite there?
Well, I've also been playing around, with those same things, and I'm uncomfortable on a variety of different levels. Some of which, I think are objective issues, and some of which are subjective issues. Mm-hmm. So on the objective issue side of things, I think that in order to provide for non-correlatable identifiers and things of that nature, that you're going to have to use more complex cryptography than what the sort of RSA based, single key based, CA based architectures are of the Jose stack. Mm-hmm. And they have a relatively constrained format that make some of those things hard. Obviously every standard can adapt, and that's where we sort of get to the subjective. I just find the Jose stack to be very cumbersome I just hate the fact that in order to both encrypt and sign something, you have to actually put the base 64 of the encrypted thing in with it because of the fact that JSON isn't consistent in how it signs or how it's represented. I mean, JSON doesn't even have lists. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It just feels ugly to me, and that's a subjective thing in many ways. But it frustrates me.
Right. On the other hand, the Jose stack is suited for doing the type of crypto and signatures for an ecosystem like this.
It's very inelegant, yes. I also feel I can't tell you yet, can it be done? Can it be coerced? Probably, but then it's going to become even more ugly.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the other problem is that now we come to the, switch hats to my cryptographer hats. This was an issue with TLS way back when. I mean, everybody had a different algorithm and hash and MAC mechanism, et cetera, that, they all wanted them to kind of be able to slide around in different ways and different combos. But auditing that from a security point of view was incredibly hard. And that's kind of the way I feel about the Jose thing, is that on one hand, if they've got some weird constraints in areas that are frustrating, but then they have this, in the areas where I want to be more constrained in the crypto, they're wild. I want to have like two or three things, or a linear growth in options rather than an exponential growth in options. And that seems to be where Jose is going.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
You're saying Jose is going in the exponential case, not the linear, and that's a bad thing?
Correct.
Right. Okay.
From a security point of view, yes.
Right.
And the fact that then we need to do things that it doesn't do now, it's going to become even more exponential.
Right.
They don't do HD keys. They don't do a number of different choices. But when they do them all as options that can all be kind of chosen and woven in or out from each other. So it becomes very, very hard to audit them.
Got it. So what do you see any technologies on the horizon that can address this type of stuff?
Part of the reason why I've been involved with the XBI standard is that, they've been trying to address, this here. I'm not as expert in, the graph technologies. I mean, graph technologies historically have led to a lot of dead ends in the past. I mean, I can even go back to, pre-internet, Xanadu got really stuck in, ontology versus taxonomy. But there's, there's some interesting things in that space to solve some of these types of problems. I've liked what's been going on with JSON-LD. I like what's been going on in XDI and the OASIS standards. And I haven't quite seen the same coming out of IETF recently.
Okay. And specifically, is that just with the data modeling side of things, or with the digital signature side of things as well?
It's more on the digital signature side of things.
Okay. All right. Okay. So as far as OpenID can go ahead.
Go ahead. I mean, the area of null nodes. Whether or not you are, have to have a giant, all the world's data in some kind of graph, cryptography has problems with null nodes, where you don't know about something and you don't want to say, you don't want to force that nullness. There's a is a real problem in cryptography.
Got it. So jumping to other technologies like OpenID Connect, OpenID Connect or SAML. Do you feel like those technologies could be modified, and you could end up with an elegant solution for a user-centric system like this, like user-centric credentials expressed using OpenID Connect and Jose and that kind of stuff?
Well, I think you could, but their architecture tends to be very client server architecture, where the server is the key party, and that's just always going to make it difficult.
So basically, like I think the assertion is the OpenID Connect and SAML are not self-sovereign type systems. They're more service-centric.
Not so much.
Or?
I mean, they aren't. They aren't. But I mean, just in the sense of, you know, how it's called, you know, how the different pieces are connected together is very oriented toward the server being persistent in ways that limit them.
Okay.
That doesn't mean you can't, I mean, it's the classic thing of it being rooted on HTML. I mean, I think that's why OWASP and some of the other different things, rose, was because of, you know, some of these different kinds of issues of, requiring sort of a server-centric approach to it.
Okay. So we're going to shift a bit to, I think what you're asserting is that there is something here, like there's something there with the problem statement, and creating this ecosystem would be a beneficial thing to try and do. You're saying that there's no clear technical solution that exists today, or if even if there was, we'd have to work on it quite a bit to get it to where it needs to be.
Especially that latter statement. I feel like it's a lot harder. So which is going to be more easily adapted to the kinds of changes that are necessary? And I think the limiting options so that there are, sort of cryptographic suites, of things is a desirable approach. That cryptography is not only done on the server, which is kind of the server in the, there's no reason why in TLS that theoretically you don't have a server send a credential at all. It's purely just the client that could you can get just the same level of cryptographic man-in-the-middle avoidance with a single certificate presented by the client. But the marketplace, the fact that in the 90s, computers had were more powerful at the server than they were at the client, meant that you tried to do as much crypto as you could at the server end of things. That's not true anymore. I mean, my iPhone has a cryptographic coprocessor inside it that has a hardened secure area in it. And even Internet of Things, when we get down to the kind of that level of stuff, they're recognizing that they have to have cryptographic hardware all the way out at the leaves. So we need a design for that.
Right. So if this work, if this work were to start, particularly which items do you think are important to work on? And then where should that work happen? So which items being are self-sovereign identifiers or self-sovereign, protocols important? And if those are important, then do we do that at IETF or W3C or OASIS, or do we create a new foundation to do it? What are the technologies that you feel need to be created, just some of the fundamental technologies you feel need to be created? And then where do you think some of that work should happen?
Well, if you start off with the base of self-sovereign, we have a wallet problem. We have a key management problem. That I think is something that is very important. I happen to be particularly biased toward hierarchical trees of keys because they allow a user to, for instance, have a root key that's in cold storage or even completely offline that can't be stolen, and yet allows them to be able to create subkeys that can then delegate and give other privileges to do other different things. So I could have my iPhone have a subkey of my master key that allows it to do a wide variety of things on my behalf. But if my phone is stolen, I can create a new subkey very, very easily. So anything, you know, I feel like that's a fundamental. We have to design it from the beginning to be able to support, you know, this type of functionality. Now, there's some other benefits you get. So, for instance, I can give, you know, my the company I'm renting my apartment from an identifier, and I can give a the company that I'm getting power for my apartment from an identifier, and they would not necessarily be able to correlate those two identifiers using a hierarchical method. They basically have two different paths down the thing. So they can't, other than the fact that, you know, maybe that's a bad example because they both have my, have to know what my physical address is. So let's take a different one, like you know, my mail provider doesn't need to know what my thing is. And if those two companies share information, that identify those identifiers should not necessarily allow them to correlate that, in fact, oh, this is the same party. It's fairly easy to do with hierarchical keys. So that's something I'm a big believer in. One of the things that with rating systems in general is a rating is only as good at the point that it was issued. So time becomes very important. You know, that's one of the areas where you know, the persistence of a rating over time is important. So I think those kind of need to be built in early on, are, you know, are sort of verifiable proofs of existence in time of something, you know, something that was, you know, valid 10 years ago, course might have changed to today, but if it's been continuous over that time and it's never been revoked and it's been, you know, new things issued, it has a lot more authority than something that was granted to me today by a new issuer.
Right. So you're saying like some kind of ledger-based mechanism or blockchain-based mechanism or history preserving mechanism might be some.
Yeah, you know, I'm not absolutely sure that this needs to be ledger, because you've got, you know, you do have issues of correlation and things of that nature, but I do believe that it does need to be provable in time, and you can do that without a ledger.
Okay. So what about identifiers, and what about the format for these verifiable claims? Do you think those are work items as well?
Absolutely. I think that I would like to see a number of good recipes. I think there are human issues in on the issues of recipes. If you let me find. I'll put a link in the IRC. So that's, you know, a beginning of a number of about 12 different blogs and papers and whatever on what I call systems for collective choice. Writing a good rating system, writing a good ranking system, writing various other kinds of systems are hard, and I think that we need to have some good recipes that that, you know, work. You know, we need to have some good use cases that we really understand the problem. you know, and maybe one of the first use cases is badges. You know, the simply that, you know, you have completed something, you know, that's less than a degree, but more than, you know, that, you know, you've opened the web page. That, you know, that there's been some kind of, you know, proof that, you know, you have read the document and understood it in some fashion, you know, is a really early, you know, recipe that I think we can design it from the human issue perspectives issue and then, you know, use that to make new recipes and design more complex things that are that are going to be harder just simply because there are more parties involved.
Right. So by recipe, are you, just to clarify, you mean like a way of expressing a set of verifiable claims? Is that what you mean by recipe? Or do you mean more like systems recipes, like how do you do a voting system if you have these credentials, how do you do a things like that? Could you clarify what you mean by recipe?
Yeah, so I don't think, I mean, okay, as an example, there are, let's just talk about, you know, you have this JSON object that I give you that basically says that, you know, I have rated the paper that you wrote, the blog post that you wrote, on a scale of 1 to 5. I've rated it as a 3.
Mm-hmm.
I can prove to you that that's problematic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
5-star rating systems are a bad design. We do them repeatedly because that's what people have seen in the past and people have gotten used to, but they have a number of serious flaws. First off, a lot of people think that 3 is the middle. Well, in fact, no, it's not. 2.5 is the middle. There is no 2.5 stars. You know, other things is that due to the nature of how you ask the questions, people are much more likely to rate things positive in certain kinds of situations. So if you look at, say, Amazon, an Amazon book rating of 4 stars is below average. It means you are actually purchasing a book that your fellow buyers have is actually less than, you know, the 50 percentile. That's not obvious. You think 4 stars as being a positive, you know, as being, oh, that must be a good book. When in fact it's a signifier that it's better, that it's less than average. 4.1 or 4.2, in fact, is an average rating for an Amazon book. So these are human side of reputation, ranking, rating, and of, you know, credentials. That any time that we have these kinds of things of that nature, we need to be very careful with them. We need to be very, you know, precise with them. You know, and look from the what happened with PGP. So I'll just pull up the actual what it means. So you know, it means you've had a peer validation of someone's public key, but then people started doing parties together where you were, you know, in a party together and you felt obligated to sign somebody else's key because they were at the party with you, not necessarily that you truly believed that they generated their key in a good way. So again, you know, a human factor got in the way of a fairly binary rating of the thing. So I think that these kinds of human issues are as important in the design of you know, what that JSON object look like.
Do you feel like there are a particular set of technologies that are better at trying to address that problem, or do you feel like this is more of like a set of design thinking around how you solve the problem?
I think it's more the latter, but that being said, schemas, are powerful.
Right.
I mean,
Go ahead.
Well, I think that's one of the things that, you have to be careful because sometimes, schemas can get in the way also. I think that was the thing that the microformats people kind of discovered was that, if you're relatively consistent in a well-designed schema that meets the use cases, it doesn't need to be as precise as, full-fledged RDF.
Right.
The schema was in some ways more important than perfectly described RDF. Having some good schemas for some of these types of things and, having a good complete discussion about, we thought carefully about this and there are human factors in reputation systems that, should be accounted for. There are UI issues in these types of things that, need to be considered, and we've, done the best that we can with those.
Right. So do you feel like, it seems like we've discussed this a bit, and I think the conclusion we've come to is that the people that design those schemas should be very, very close to the problem. So, for example, if you're designing a schema for hospitals to ingest and figure out, all the people that are credentialed at the hospital, it should be the hospital community or the people that are building IT systems for that hospital to figure out the schema and the human factors and all that kind of stuff. It shouldn't be some standardization body at the W3C, for example, or OASIS or whatever, right? So the point being that you need to have experts in that particular vertical to do a good job with the human factors and the schema.
Right.
Would you agree
I agree with that the caveat of I do believe that a standards body can basically say, hey, these are some of the steps and perils and pitfalls that you can fall into if you're not careful. And here is our advice about how to avoid those things.
Got it. Kind of like a best practices document around creating schemas and human factors stuff. Okay.
Yeah, and showing some good and demonstrating some of the those areas that can be done, some of the best practices, and then explain a little bit the behind the scenes of, here is, why we chose, like I said, I think a low-hanging fruit is a badge. And I have a particular definition of a badge. So what is that definition? What is the, why is it relevant? Where are there problems? How are we avoiding those problems? Are good lessons for you when you're designing your recipe for this.
Right. Okay. Okay, that makes sense. So we are out of time, and I really appreciate you staying an extra 15 minutes. Are there any other things that you wanted to cover? As far as where this work can happen, do you feel like, you know, IETF W3C, OASIS, or somewhere else? Do you have any strong feelings about any of that?
The whole standards area has gotten, I would say IETF 20 years ago, but I think they're all difficult today. IETF is not the same organization today as it was. I personally found W3C a little bit harder for small companies to be involved with. And that's been a personal issue. It also feels a little bit dominated by the big browser vendors and companies where, you know, I'd like to see a little bit broader non-computer industry backing in there, but you know they're not there. I only have limited exposure to the OASIS standards community in the last 9 months or so, and it at least enforces the key things of, patent waivers and things of that nature, which I think is kind of the minimum requirement for any standards organization to, that's going to do its job, is to make sure that all the parties are fairly represented. IETF feels a little too low now. It feels a little bit too close to the metal in a way for this type of stuff.
Okay.
But they are doing some of the more, more interesting work in crypto. So,
specifically what part?
But technically it's not the IETF, it's actually the IESG that I think is doing the more interesting crypto stuff, which isn't technically IETF.
Okay. Interesting. The Crypto Forum Research Group, those folks, CRFG?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
That's it.
Okay. Yes, agreed. Okay. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for your time today. We really, really appreciate it. Unless you have anything else to add, anything else that you feel we should be thinking about with this work, to be clear, you think this is something that's worthwhile to try and do some work around? Specifically around self-sovereign identifiers and the crypto bits and the schemas and vocabularies and expressing these verifiable claims.
Yes.
Okay. All right. With that, thank you very much again. Have a wonderful rest of the week, and we'll go ahead and CC you on this stuff when we send the minutes out.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.